Underworld, Disc 19.
June 14th, 1957. There were weeks went by when we barely slept. We were together every hour of the day and night for 3 or 4 weeks, much of it, most of it, in her car, eating and sleeping there, having sex in her car, sleeping and waking up and looking around, and it was still dark, or still light, depending. And finally we'd stop driving for one reason or another, logical or not, and life had slowed down enough so things could happen normally in rooms. But only until it was time to go again, and she'd rumble up in the 1950 Merc, chassis lowered and driveline slightly souped, and we were headed west again. "Don't tell me your dreams," I said.
"But you have to hear."
"I don't want to hear."
"Oh, you bastard, you have to hear," Amy said, "because everything that happens has to happen to both of us."
"Don't you know people don't want to hear other people's dreams?"
"Oh, you bastard, what other people? Who are these other people?"
"Watch the road.
Every smallest thought we said we'd share."
"Watch the road. Drive the car," I told her. And once I dropped her off in Santa Fe, where she had family, friends, and kept the car myself, and didn't play the radio or read the newspaper. And she caught up with me a week later in a miner's bar in Bisbee, Arizona, and we played a flirty game of liar's poker, and climbed the high, tight streets, and felt a thing so powerful, and knew the other felt it, that we thought our faces might ignite. It was a mountain dream, a high, clear place near a lake. Don't you know dreams are only interesting to the dreamer? Think you're so worldly wise, you're awfully smart for a foreigner. Drive the car, who only learned English when he left New York. Amy was tall and competent and looked good in jeans. She knew how to do things and make things, and even her good looks were competent, a straightforward sort of ableness, open and clear-eyed, with a smatter of fading freckles and a dirty-minded smile. And once we were in Yankton, South Dakota, early on that summer, and the movie theater was just letting out. The Dakota, it was called, with a bright tile facade and Audie Murphy on the marquee. And the young people of Yankton got in their cars and drove up and down the main drag, and we drove with them, nearly falling asleep. And we went to drive-in movies and talked about life, and we rode across prairies and talked about movies. And we drove through car washes and read poetry aloud, one of us to the other. The soapy water slid down the windows. Her car was black and hooded-looking, and we thought we were phantoms of the road, djinns who could pee unseen in the country dust. She didn't want me to know her father had given her the car, a graduation gift. But this was a thing I knew because one of her brothers had told me. And the other thing I knew was that she'd dropped me cold when the trip was done. "You know what's interesting about you? You say you want to share the smallest thought, but what's interesting about you," I said, "is that you're going to forget everything we said and everything we did and every thought we shared the minute... No. The minute... No. The minute we say goodbye. Because you know what you are? A practical, hard-headed, more or less calculating individual who is planning 10 years ahead and knows every passing minute for what it is." "What is it?" "A thing you drain every drop of juice from so you can forget it in the morning." And once we stopped at some stables, and she tried to teach me to ride, but I got up there and got down again, and would not get back up. And she rode off with the Indian who led the expeditions into the cool hills. She said, "What's wrong with that?" "I'm just talking."
She said, "Draining every minute, what's wrong with that?"
"I'm talking.
And I haven't told you everything, so don't accuse," she said.
"You've told me everything twice."
"You are such a bastard."
"Tell me things you haven't told me. Go ahead, shock me," I said.
"You're not shocking me."
She could make and fix things, and she liked to talk about the Brookhiser family. the grandparents and pioneer women and gold panners, and all the far-flung offspring of the old rugged stock. And once we stayed with her oldest brother, an architect, sleeping in separate rooms. She seemed to have brothers everywhere. This one lived near Yuma in a lopsided house he'd built himself, skewed for effect, out of railroad ties and stucco and stamped tin. And Amy was in an elevated state, looking sideways at the place. We were partly out of our minds from driving, and we talked at each other across half a major state, pretty much nonstop. And we had the chemistry of a whole long, brutal marriage compressed into weeks. The twang in the air of a thing that stays unadjusted. And we also had the feeling it was wrong to sleep, because we could be saying something awful and important. And once we drove along a dirt road somewhere near Ruby, Arizona, and saw four men on horseback driving a bull, a humped bull of amazing size, nearly unreal. And we stopped not only to watch, and not only because we thought the animal might charge a moving car, but out of a strange and pagan respect, an animal so awesome, a Brahma bull. And the cowboys waved and drove the bull down the red dirt road. "I had these tantrums in my mind," she said, "where you'd hate me if I told you these raging, throwing things of sex and jealousy and spite and wishing the worst kind of pain and slow death on someone who was close."
"Tell me."
"I won't tell you. Not even you. Least of all, you."
"I want you to tell me."
"I won't unless you make me," she said. Amy had a dance-away manner at times. She had a ritual thing she did, a reflex, not coy, but wary and foxy. Pulling away from me the more she showed a need, dancing away, eyes bright, her shoulder rounding against my approach. She could be skittish even in the midst of the act, close to pretending we weren't doing this, but something else entirely. I don't know, holding hands in a school corridor, maybe. And sometimes she turned me down flat, saying, "No, you can't," or, "No, I won't," even as we sprawled on the seat, screwing. I thought our faces might flare up and disappear the night in mid-June when we climbed the narrow stepped streets of Bisbee, Arizona, shocked by love, sort of self-erased, after a beer and a sandwich in a dark bar filled with copper miners and their heartworm dogs. I didn't know it was possible to feel a thing like this, and then to feel it together, our heads half blown away, and our minds emptied out, lost to everything but love. She said, "I know what you do. You stay awake and watch me when I sleep."
"When do you sleep?"
"You want too much. You want to crawl inside me, basically. You want to follow your cock right in.
Did it ever occur to me?"
"Drive the car."
"No, but did it ever occur to me?"
"Don't look at me when you drive."
"No, but did it ever occur to me that I would know a man someday who tries to follow me into the bathroom?"
"Drive the car."
She said, "You wanted to crowd into the gas station toilet with me. I just remembered. I almost forgot. Because you thought you might miss something."
And once we were passing through Bakersfield, California, and the car overheated, and we stopped for water at a trailer camp. And this was something I absolutely did not know about. All these rows of trailer homes with people cooking hot dogs in 107 heat. A woman in a bathing suit ironing clothes on an ironing board outside her trailer, with small kids riding tricycles in their underwear. And this was a thing I did not know existed, absolutely, or could ever conceive, a thing I had completely missed, people living permanently in trailers. And Amy called me a foreigner from New York. I was going to Palo Alto, a textbook editor, fledgling, with an outfit determined to change the nature of the classroom. Make it open, fluid, casual, and Californian. And she was headed up to Seattle, or Portland, she wasn't sure which, or back across to Denver with a master's in earth science and a number of professional connections she wasn't letting on to.
"I don't know what I'm doing here with you," I don't know anything about you. All this time and all this talk, and I don't know anything about you, basically, she said, except for the fact that you know how to make me mad. Good. It's good for you. Getting mad cleans the blood, I told her, according to my Irish mother. You have a mother. This is encouraging. Get mad. Be mad, I told her. I didn't want her looking at me while she drove, but sometimes I looked at her and invited a look back. I want everything that happens to happen to both of us, she said. So do I said, and meant it, at the time, truly. She felt the weight of the gaze and looked across at me on the empty road, with a mountain of lavender tailings rising above the old sheds that marked a mine works. And it was a look so intimate and reaching, so deep in things we'd done, that it became a crazy kind of dare, a form of drag-strip chicken. Which one of us would break the lover's gaze and look away first to see if the car had wandered into the eastbound lane with a shiny-eye pickup approaching half a second from dazzling death? "Who's strange?" I said. "You stay awake and watch me when I sleep. I know you do. I feel it in my sleep. I'm strange or you're strange? You followed me into a ladies' room. No, wait, 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 wait. You can feel me watching you while you sleep, and you think I'm strange? Who's strange?" I said. And there were times when you detached yourself from the steepest breathing, even, and felt a kind of white shadow, a sliding away into a parallel person, someone made of mind light who seemed to speak for you. Or, "You can't make me do this," she'd say, running her hand up the seam of my fly, and I'm trying to drive the car. And once, when I was alone for a day and a night, not playing the radio or reading the newspaper, and driving around aimlessly for hours, I finally stopped and parked and took a walk in a picnic grounds, where there were white-barked trees and garbage cans for food scraps, and a man who looked disturbed sitting on a bench outside Fresno somewhere, but maybe he was only deep in thought or worried about something. And I felt a sadness I couldn't exactly locate, a feeling that could have been mine or could have been theirs, the little families with food on paper plates, the unhappy man slouched on the bench, the place itself, the bench itself, the trash cans that didn't have lids. I bought a postcard to send her after she went her way and I went mine, a card that showed a picnic table in the trees. And I slipped it in a book inside my bag, until I had time to figure out what kind of message I would write. Chapter 4. November 28th, 1966. The first man stood by the window of his stately suite at the Waldorf. He watched the yellow cabs sink into soulful dusk, that particular spendthrift light that falls dyingly on Park Avenue in the hour before people take leave of the office and become husbands and wives again. Or whatever people become in whatever murmurous words when evenings grow swift and whispered. The second man sat on the sofa, legs crossed, looking at bureau reports. Edgar said, "Of course you packed the masks." The second man nodded yes, a gesture that went unseen. "Junior, the masks?" "We have them, yes. I'm looking at a security memo that's a little, actually, rankling."
"I don't want to hear it. File it somewhere. I feel too good."
"Protest outside the plaza tonight."
"What is it the bastards are protesting? Pray tell," Edgar said, in a tone he'd perfected through the years, a tight amusement etched in 11 kinds of irony.
"The war, it seems."
"The war?"
"Yes, that," the second man said. They were staying at the Waldorf, which was J. Edgar Hoover's hotel of choice during his sojourns in New York, But the party was taking place, the ball, the fete, the social event of the season, the decade, the half-century, no doubt. The ball was in the ballroom at the plaza. Edgar changed the subject, if only in his mind. He gazed far up Park, where the earth curved toward Harlem. Maybe the deep and fleeting light was making him nostalgic, or the noise, perhaps, the muted clamor of taxi horns below, a sound at this protected distance that was oddly and humanly happy, little toots and beeps that seemed to carry a pitch of celebration. He said,
"Where were you when Thompson hit the homer?"
"Beg pardon?
Where were you?"
"Yes?"
"Never mind. An idle thought, Junior."
Clyde Tolson, known as Junior, was Edgar's staunchest aide in the Bureau, his dearest friend and inseparable companion.
They were getting on, of course. Clyde was 5 years younger than Edgar, but not so sharp as he used to be, his flashcard memory a little less prodigious now. But where Edgar was pug-nosed and compact, with brows like bat wings, Clyde was long-jawed and tallish, sort of semi-debonair. A fairly gentle fellow who liked conversation, again unlike his boss, who thought you gave yourself away, word by word, every time you opened your trap to speak. Edgar held a tumbler of scotch. He checked the glass for smudges, then sniffed and sipped, feeling the charred fumes prickle his tongue. The complimentary sweet, the soothing booze, the presence of Junior in the room, the party that everybody'd been talking about for months, famous long before it happened, the uninvited lapsing into states of acute confusion, insomniac, unable to function. Yes, Edgar was feeling pretty good tonight. Talkative or not, he loved a good party. He loved celebrities in particular, and there would be an abundance of mammal glamour at the plaza tonight. Personage and flair and stylish wit. A frail schoolboy still crouched inside the director's pudgy corpus, and this lonely crypto child came to robust life in the presence of showpeople and other living icons, child stars, ballplayers, prize fighters, even Hollywood horses and dogs. Celebrated people were master spirits, men and women who spiked the temper of the age. Whatever Edgar's own claim to rank and notoriety, he found himself subject to anal flutters when chatting with a genuine celeb. Clyde said, "And this, of course, as well." Edgar didn't turn to see what the second man was reading. He studied the carpet instead. The carpets of the Waldorf were thick and lush, nesting grounds for bacteria of every sort. If you knew anything about modern war, you knew that weapons utilizing pathogenic bacteria could be every bit as destructive as megaton bombs. Worse, in a way, because the sense of infiltration was itself a form of death. Clyde said, "I knew it was a mistake to publicize our methods regarding organized crime figures." "What methods?"
"Ransacking their garbage."
"Makes good copy."
"And creates a copycat mentality. Now we have a situation that's a public relations nightmare. To wit, a so-called garbage gorilla is targeting guess who's garbage, boss?"
"Please, I'm enjoying my drink. A man enjoys a drink when the day winds down."
"Yours," Clyde said. Edgar couldn't believe he'd heard the fellow correctly. "This is what our confidential source tells us."
And Clyde rattled the page he was reading for maximum nuisance effect. "Team of urban gorillas planning a garbage raid at 4936 30th Place, Northwest, Washington, D.C. It was the end of the world in triplicate.
"When is this supposed to happen?"
"More or less momentarily."
"You've posted guards?"
"In unmarked cars. But whether we arrest them or not, they will find a way to make public theater of your garbage."
"I won't put the garbage out."
"You have to put it out eventually."
"I'll put it out and lock it up."
"How will the garbage collectors collect it?"
When FBI agents stole off in the night with some mobster's household trash, they substituted fake garbage to allay suspicion. Aromatic food scraps, anchovy tins, used tampons prepared by the lab division. Then they took the real garbage back for analysis by forensic experts on gambling, handwriting, fragmented paper, crumpled photographs, food stains, blood stains, and every known subclass of a scribbled Sicilian.
"Or do this," Edgar said. "Put out simulated garbage. Bland bits and pieces, unnewsworthy."
"We can't use conventional methods, however clever, on these people, because what they're doing flies in the face of ordinary confrontation.
And no matter how well guarded the premises, sooner or later they'll snatch a trash can and make off with it."
Edgar walked over to another window. He needed a change, as they say, of scene.
"Confidential source says they intend to take your garbage on tour, rent halls in major cities, get lefty sociologists to analyze the garbage item by item, get hippies to rub it on their naked bodies, more or less have sex with it, get poets to write poems about it, and finally, in the last city on the tour, they plan to eat it."
Edgar could see part of the east facade of the plaza, about a dozen blocks away.
"And expel it," Clyde said. "Publicly."
The great slate roof, the gables and dormers and copper cresting. How odd it seemed that such a taken-for-granted thing, putting out the garbage, could suddenly be a source of the gravest anxiety.
"Confidential source says they will make a documentary film of the tour for general release."
"Do we have a dossier on these guerrillas?"
"Yes."
"Is it massive?" Edgar said.
In the endless estuarial mingling of paranoia and control, the dossier was an essential device. Edgar had many enemies for life, and the way to deal with such people was to compile massive dossiers. Photographs, surveillance reports, detailed allegations, linked names, transcribed tapes, wiretaps, bugs, break-ins. The dossier was a deeper form of truth, transcending facts and actuality. The second you placed an item in the file, a fuzzy photograph, an unfounded rumor, it became promiscuously true. It was a truth without authority and therefore incontestable. Factoids seeped out of the file and crept across the horizon, consuming bodies and minds. The file was everything, the life nothing. And this was the essence of Edgar's revenge. He rearranged the lives of his enemies, their conversations, their relationships, their very memories, and he made these people answerable to the details of his creation.
"We'll arrest them and charge them," Clyde said. "That's all we can do."
Edgar turned from the window, smiling.
"Maybe I can sympathize with the mafia over this."
Clyde smiled.
"You were always half a gangster," he said.
They laughed.
"Remember the Tommy guns we carried?" Edgar said.
"When the photographers were around?"
They laughed again.
"You were right there alongside me, posed heroically."
"Edgar and Clyde," said Clyde.
"Clyde and Edgar," said Edgar.
Where the current of one's need for control met the tide of one's paranoia, this was where the dossier was reciprocally satisfying. You fed both forces in a single stroke.
"I liked the 30s, Edgar said. "I don't like the 60s. No, not at all."
The desk at the end of the room was out of the 30s, in a way, equipped with items fashioned to Edgar's specifications. 2 nibbed black pens, 2 bottles of Scrip Permanent Royal Blue Ink, number 52, 6 sharpened Eberhard Faber pencils, number 2, a pair of 5x8 linen finish writing pads, white, a new 60-watt bulb in the standing lamp. The director did not want to breathe the dust of old bulbs used to illuminate the reading matter of total strangers. Newspapers, guidebooks, Gideon Bibles, erotic literature, subversive literature, underground literature, literature. Whatever people read in hotels, alone, thumbing and breathing. Clyde checked his watch. Dinner first, the two of them, alone, a practice spanning the decades, then the short ride to the plaza. It was called the Black and White Ball, a godlike gathering of 500, a masked affair, invitation only, dinner jacket and black mask for men, evening gown and white mask for women. The party was being given by a writer, Truman Capote, for a publisher, Catherine Graham, and the factoidal data generated by the guests would surely bridge the narrowing gap between journalism and fiction. Edgar hadn't been invited, initially, but arranging an invitation wasn't difficult. A word from Edgar to Clyde, a word from Clyde to someone close to Capote. They were in the files, of course, a number of those involved in planning the event, all catalogued and dossiered up to their eyeballs, and none of them eager to offend the director. Clyde took a call from the desk. The mask lady was coming up for a fitting. Edgar noticed that Clyde was wearing a necktie with a driblet design. The little figures made him think of Paramecia, sinister organisms with gullets and feeding grooves. At home, Edgar sat on a toilet that was raised on a platform to isolate him from floor-bound forms of life. And he'd ordered his lab people to build a clean room at the bureau with unprecedented standards of hygiene, a white room manned by white-clad technicians, preferably white themselves, who would work in an environment completely free of contaminants, dust, bacteria, and so on, with big white lights shining down, where Edgar himself might like to spend time when he was feeling vulnerable to the forces around him. She walked in the door, Tanya Berenger, in a maxi dress and thrift shop boots, once a well-known costume designer, now ancient and frowsy, living in a room in a sad hotel off Times Square, a place where the desk clerk sits behind a grill eating a tongue sandwich. People tracked her down 3 or 4 times a year to do masks for special occasions, and she found fairly steady work doing sadomasochistic accessories for a private club in the village. The two men, as always with a female in the room, someone they didn't know, and without others present, and lacking an atmosphere of sociable cheer, well, they tended to become stiff and defensive, as though surprised by an armed intruder. Clyde did not stray from Edgar's side, sensing a potential for wayward behavior on the woman's part. She wore heavy makeup she might have poured from a paint can and cooked. And Clyde noted how one pocket on her dress drooped just a bit, becoming unseamed. She spoke to Edgar with a sort of rueful affection. "You know I can't let you wear one of my masks, dear man, without a consultation. I must put my hands on the living head. Bad enough I had to create my objet from a set of written specifications, like I'm a plumber installing a sink already." She had a European accent slashed and burned by long-term residency in New York, and her hair had the retouched gloss of a dead crow mounted on a stick. Of course, Clyde had been briefed on Tanya Berenger. She was in the files in a fairly big way. She'd been accused at various times of being a lesbian, a socialist, a communist, a dope addict, a divorcee, a Jew, a Catholic, a Negro, an immigrant, and an unwed mother. Just about everything Edgar distrusted and feared. But she did exquisite masks, and Clyde had been quick to commission her for the job. He hurried into Edgar's bedroom and fetched the mask. When she held it in her hands, she looked at Edgar and looked at the mask, weighing the equation. And the director experienced a queer tension in his chest, wondering whether he was worthy. She held the object at eye level, 6 inches from her face, and looked through the eye holes at Edgar. And Edgar, in turn, looked at the mask as if it had a life, an identity of its own that he might feel ballsy enough to borrow for a single midnight on the town. It was a sleek black leather mask with handlebar extensions and a scatter of shiny sequins around the eyes. Tanya said, "You want to put it on, or have a conversation with it?"
but he wasn't quite ready.
Do I want to put it on, Junior?
Be brave.
Tanya said,
Leather, it's so real, you know? Like wearing someone else's face.
She fitted the mask over Edgar's head. The padded band not too tight, and the leather alive on his skin. Then she took him by the shoulders and turned him slowly toward the mirror over the desk. Clyde took the whiskey glass from his hand. The mask transformed him. For the first time in some years, he did not see himself as a tenant in an old, short, popover body with an immense and lumpish head.
I can call you Edgar. This is okay?
I can tell you how I see you.
I see you as a mature and careful man who has a sexy motorcycle thug writhing to get out. Which the spangles give a crazy twist, you know?
He felt creamy, dreamy, and drugged. She made a slight adjustment in the fit, and even as he cringed at her touch, Edgar felt himself tingle thrillingly. She was insidious and corrupt, and it was like hearing your grandmother talk dirty in your ear.
You are a butch biker to me, you know, riding into town to take over leadership of the sadists and necrophiles.
Clyde watched in civilized alarm as a cockroach crawled out of Tanya's pocket and moved slowly down her flank. It was Spanish Harlem-sized, with antennae that could pick up the BBC.
It's a lovely fit, darling. You have savage cheekbones for a full-figure man. I would love to do the total face, you know. Highlights and shadows.
Clyde took her gently by the arm, concealing her roach side from Edgar's view.
In fact, shall I tell you something? The ball tonight is a perfect setting for you, because you are very black and white to me. So you'll be totally in character, yes?
When she was gone, the men busied themselves with practical preparations. Clyde made dinner reservations and set out their evening clothes. Edgar set the mask on a tabletop and took a bath. When he was finished, he put on his fluffy white robe and stood by a window, sipping the rest of his drink. He heard a sound above the beeping traffic, something strident rising in the night. New York was less genial than it used to be, when the saloons and supper clubs were hangouts for lively and charming women and for gentlemen bums with a comic flair.
Junior, that noise. Can you hear it?
Clyde walked into the room in his shirt sleeves, a shoe brush in hand.
Yes, barely.
Is it possible?
Yes, it could be the protesters at the plaza.
The wind?
Yes, the wind is carrying the sound this way.
They heard the hard, rhythmic salvo of voices chanting angry slogans again, louder, fading when the wind shifted, then audible once more.
You know what they want, don't you?
Edgar said. Through the battered century of world wars and massive violence by other means, there had always been an undervoice that spoke through the cannon fire and ack-ack, and that sometimes grew strong enough to merge with the battle sounds. It was the struggle between the state and secret groups of insurgents, state-born, wild-eyed, the anarchists, terrorists, assassins, and revolutionaries who tried to bring about apocalyptic change. And sometimes, of course, succeeded. The passionate task of the state was to hold on, stiffening its grip and preserving its claims to the most destructive power available. With nuclear weapons, this power became identified totally with the state. The mushroom cloud was the godhead of annihilation and ruin. The state controlled the means of apocalypse. But Edgar, by the window, heard the old alarums. He thought the time might be coming once again when ideas became insurgent and rebel bands were reborn. Long-haired men and women, scruffy and free-fucking, who moved toward armed and organized resistance, trying to break the state and bring about the end of the existing order.
They want the power to shake the world. It's the old Bolshevik dream being dreamed again, and it's the communists who are behind it all. And you know where it begins, don't you?
These are kids, mostly, who lie down in the streets and wave flowers at the police, Clyde said. Vietnam is the war, the reality. This is the movie, where the scripts are written and the actors perform. American kids don't want what we've got. They want movies, music.
Let Junior devise his clever perceptions. He didn't understand that once you patronize the enemy, you begin the process of your own undoing. It begins in the inmost person, Edgar said. Once you yield to random sexual urges, you want to see everything come loose. You mistake your own looseness for some political concept, whereas in truth...
He didn't finish the thought. Some thoughts had to remain unspoken, even unfinished in one's own mind. This was the point of his relationship with Clyde, to keep the subject unspoken, to keep the feelings unfelt, the momentary urges unacted upon. How strange and foolish this would seem to the young people running in the streets, or living six to a room, or three to a bed, and to many other people, for that matter. How sad and rare. Clyde went back to his duties, leaving the boss by the window. Edgar thought there was something noble in a constant companionship that does not fall to baser claims. He assumed Clyde believed likewise. But then Clyde was the second man, wasn't he? And perhaps he only followed Edgar's line of march wherever it led. Or didn't. He heard the chanting intermittently on the wind. Clyde was in the shower now. Edgar turned to see where he'd left the mask and saw himself unexpectedly in a full-length mirror across the room in his white robe and soft slippers, and he was startled by the image. Of course it was him, but him in the guise of a macrocephalic baby, sexless and so just born as to be, in essence, unearthly. Mother Hoover's cuddled runt. He crossed the room and picked up the mask. He noted how the stylized handlebars were simple swirls of cut leather designed to flare from the temples. He heard Clyde come out of the shower. When they were younger and on vacation together, or away on business, sharing a suite or taking adjoining rooms and keeping the connecting door open so they could talk from their respective beds well into the night, Edgar sometimes managed to angle the mirrors in such a way that he could catch a glimpse by taking the freestanding antique in an old inn, the cheval glass, for example, and simply moving it to another part of the floor, or opening the medicine cabinet to a certain position when he shaved and letting the mirror absorb the light from the bed in the next room, or leaving a hand mirror propped on a desk, a glimpse, a passing glance, a spy-hole peek at Junior as he busied himself dressing or undressing or taking a bath, the arrangement being such that the moment would seem wholly accidental, should the subject realize he was being watched, and an accident not just from his perspective, but to Edgar's own mind as well. Junior's likeness being a thing that might simply float across his ken in the normal course of events, away on urgent bureau business, his companion's body lean and virile, or at a golf resort, or following the ponies west to Del Mar, when they were both a great deal younger. Junior was going bald now and bulb-nosed, and he walked with a stoop. But then Junior had always walked with a stoop, in an effort to appear no taller than the boss. Edgar was in the bedroom with the door closed. He stood at the mirror, a 71-year-old man, wearing nothing but his sequined biker's mask and his wool-lined slippers, listening to the voices in the street. January 9th, 1967. When her workday was finished, Janet Urbaniak put on her running shoes. There was a stretch of four desolate blocks between the hospital complex where she did classroom work and got floor experience and the apartment complex where she lived. Bleak and weedy streets, unshoveled snow going grim with bus exhaust, snow that was drilled and gilded with dog piss,
and there were usually a few lurking figures in green fatigues, the last of a straggle battalion of wasted men. So when her workday was finished, Janet took off her lightweight casual slip-ons and got the running shoes out of her locker, a pair of firm, padded sneakers with shock-absorbent midsoles and a supple and confident feel. Then she went and stood at the hospital entrance with another student nurse, and they waited for the traffic lights to turn green along the semi-deserted length of the four extended blocks, the kind of heartless boulevard you find in parts of town where the architecture is guarded and tense, and it always feels like curfew. Janet stood and waited in the deep and eerie dusk. Then the lights went green, and her buddy said, "Go, go, go, go!" And Janet started to run, non-stop, she hoped, with the lights in her favor, hitting top speed in a matter of seconds and trying to avoid icy patches. And her buddy watched her all the way. Some evenings, most evenings, it's the men you want to look out for. This is why you're running, after all. They see you coming in your bouncy blue and white shoes and have things to say and gestures to make, or just looks to look, or nothing at all sometimes. You're a ghost, a shadow, a number of men clustered near a chain-link fence or empty lot. And you're never sure whether it's better to veer away in a defensive arc or keep running in a straight line, because the first tactic might offend them and the second might tempt them to get familiar, or maybe even affront them in its unaffectedness. And some evenings it's the snow. It's the snow or rain or garbage or the stray dogs you have to look out for. But you're not running because of the dogs. The dogs make you slow down, ease into a walk. It's the men loitering who make you run, and the men who are out of sight in doorways or junked cars. You want them to think you're running for the love of running, you and all the others, the evening stream of students making the four-block sprint. "We're just runners," you want them to think, "getting our minutes in." Janet was dashing now, deep breathing, concentrating on the snow and on the light staying green, and she watched for men who might be leaning on a wall or getting out of a car. There were usually a couple of junked cars in the course of a run used as social clubs in winter. Four long blocks under a streaky northern sky. When she reached the entrance to her building, the keys were already in her hand, and she went inside and took the elevator up, still running in a sense, with the apartment keys out now. And 15 seconds after she was in the living room, door double-locked, the telephone rang. It was only then that her heart stopped racing. The call was routine procedure, another student back at the hospital checking to see if she'd made it safely. They gave her 11 minutes door-to-door, including the elevator up and the keys in the locks. A number of student nurses lived in the same complex, and the routine was designed to allow people to switch roles systematically. Janet ran the dash, made the phone call, and monitored the progress of the running woman according to a schedule. They figured it all out and posted it on a board. Then they changed into running shoes and waited for green. November 29th, 1966. The second man made the decision to show up late. It was the kind of firm determination in the type of difficult circumstance that Clyde Tolson liked to make. It proved his mettle. And when you're a man who is variously described as dutiful, deferential, obsequious, slavish, and brown-nosingly corrupt in descending order of distinction, you need to make a show of character now and then. But first, Clyde had to convince the boss that missing an hour or two of party time was not going to haunt the twilight years of his directorate. An FBI security detail at the plaza had reported that the protest was growing loud and that the party guests, as they entered, were being cursed in rhyming couplets, exposed to obscene signs and gestures, spat upon at close range, and forced to duck an occasional flying object. It didn't make sense to Clyde to allow the director to enter a situation, and Edgar finally agreed, in which the dignity of the bureau might be compromised. So it was midnight when the two men rolled through the deserted midtown streets in their bulletproof black Cadillac. They'd had a leisurely dinner, bantering with the wine steward, and then enjoying a brandy at the bar with old acquaintances, because there were old acquaintances wherever J. Edgar Hoover went. Some who were loyal supporters, others residing in the files, a few who were enemies for life but didn't know it yet. And Edgar and Clyde were in a mellow enough mood, despite reports from the site, seated in the plush rear seat, in black tie, of course, and wearing their masks, like a suave and jaunty crime fighter out of the Sunday comics, a master bureaucrat by day who becomes dashing mask man at night, cruising the streets in formal dress with his trusted right-hand man. The driver activated the intercom to report that a car was tailing them. Clyde turned to look while the director slumped in his seat, getting his head below the window line. "Little Volkswagen Bug," Clyde said. "Painted top to bottom in very bright colors. Psychedelic. Big bright swirls and streaks. Can't make out the driver's face." The Cadillac coasted slowly past the plaza. The Klieg lights were gone. The media pack was gone. There was no trace of the crush of curious onlookers drawn by news of the event. There were still a few demonstrators, listless now, young people in their grimy tie-dyes, and city cops as well, idlers still, showing the eternal, laden strain of a big meal hustled down the gullet where it sits for hours earning overtime. The great dark car circled the block, equipped with an Arpège atomizer that contained room freshener, and Clyde checked the other entrances. The north steps were empty, and he tapped on the glass, and the driver pulled up, and the two men exited, and suddenly there was the VW, cutting in front. And people came scrambling out, 3, 4, what, 6 people. It's a circus car debauching clowns. About 7 people tumbling onto the sidewalk and hurrying up the steps to flank the doorway. All wore masks, the faces of Asian kids, some blood-spattered, others with eyes seamed shut. And they commenced their shouting as Hoover and Tolson moved up the stairs. The first man was clumsy and slow, and the second took his arm to assist, and they made their plodding way toward the entrance. They heard, "Society scum!" They heard, "A dead Asian baby for every Gucci loafer!" Clyde wasn't sure whether the protesters knew who they were. Was Edgar's mask sufficient cover for his gnarled old media mug? They heard mottos, slurs, and technical terms. And they labored upward, step by step, eyes front, outer arms stroking, and the protesters jangled and hissed, "Vietnam! Love it or leave it! White killers in black tie!" A young woman stood at the entrance wearing the mask of a child's shattered face, and she said somewhat softly to Edgar, blocking his way and speaking evenly, whispering, in fact, "We'll never disappear, old man, until you're in a landfill with your trash." Clyde said, "Coming through," like a waiter with a heavy tray. And a couple of minutes later, after a stop in the men's room to collect themselves, the director and his aide were ready to party. But first Edgar said, "Who were those Jaspers?" "I have an idea or two. I'll put someone on it."
"Did you hear what she said? I think they're connected to the garbage guerrillas."
"Straighten your mask," Clyde said.
"I'd like to see them maimed in the slowest possible manner, over weeks and months, with voice tapes made."
They walked down the hall to the grand ballroom. They'd walked down 500 halls on their way to some ceremonial event, some testimonial dinner, one or another ritual salute to Edgar's decades in the Bureau. But they had never heard a sound such as this. A subdued roar, a sort of rumble buzz, with a chandelier jingle in the mix, and the dreamy sway of dance music, and a vocal note of self-delight, the lure, the enticement of a life defined by its remoteness from the daily drudge of world complaint.
"Tapes of cries and moans," Edgar said, "which I would play to help me sleep."
They moved through the ballroom. They circulated, seeing prominent people everywhere. The room was high and white and primrose gold, flanked by Greek columns that caught the lickety amber light of 1,000 candles. swan-necked women in textured satin gowns, masks by Halston, Adolfo, and Saint Laurent. The mother and sister of one American president and the daughter of another. Crisp little men a swagger with assets. Titled jet-setters, a Maharaja and Maharani, a baroness somebody in a beaded mask. Famous and raging alcoholic poets. Tough, smart, stylish women who ran fashion books and designed clothes. Hair by Kenneth, teased, swirled, back-combed, and ringleted. Did you see?
The old dowager, Edgar said.
In the dime store mask.
Decorated with pearls. They shook hands here and there, daintily, and dropped a flattering remark to this or that person. And Clyde knew how the director felt, mixing with people of the rarest social levels, the anointed and predestined, aured like Inca kings, but also the talented and original and self-made and born beautiful and ego-driven and hard-bargaining, all bearing signs of astral radiance, and the ruthless and brutish as well. Yes, Edgar was damp with excitement. He stopped to chat with Frank Sinatra and his young actress wife, a nymph in a boy's haircut and a butterfly mask.
Jedgar, you old warhorse. Haven't seen you since...
Yes, I know.
Tempest fugits, don't it, pal?
Yes, it does, Edgar said. Introduce me to your lovely.
Sinatra was in the files now. Many people in the room were in the files as well. Not a single one of them, Clyde imagined, more accomplished in his occupational strokes than Edgar himself. But Edgar did not carry the glow. Edgar worked in the semi-dark, manipulating and bringing ruin. He carried the small, wan, grudging glory of the civil servant, not the open and confident show, the wide-striding boom of some of these cosmic bravos. On the stage, under the furled curtain, two bands took turns, a white society band and a black soul group, all musicians masked. People loved Edgar's leather mask, they told him so. A woman in ostrich feathers ran her tongue over the handlebars. Another woman called him Biker Boy. A gay playwright rolled his eyes. They found their table and settled in for a spell, sipping champagne and nibbling on buffet tidbits. Clyde uttered the names of people dancing past, and Edgar commented on their lives and careers and personal predilections. Whatever anecdotal lore he failed to recall, Clyde was quick to provide. Andy Warhol walked by wearing a mask that was a photograph of his own face. A woman asked Edgar to dance, and he flushed and lit a cigarette. Lord and Lady Somebody held their masks on sticks. A woman wore a sexy nun's wimple. A man wore an executioner's hood. Edgar spoke rapidly in his old staccato voice, like a radio reporter doing a series of punchy news items. It made Clyde feel good to see the boss show such animation. They spotted a number of people they knew professionally, administration faces, past and present, men who held sensitive and critical positions. And Clyde noted how the ballroom seemed to throb with cross-current interests and appetites. Political power mingling lubriciously with art and literature. Domed historians clubbing with the beautiful people of society and fashion. There were diplomats dancing with movie stars, and Nobel laureates telling chummy stories to shipping tycoons, and the demi-monde of Broadway and the gossip industry hobnobbing with foreign correspondents. There was a self-conscious sense of some profound moment in the making. A dreadful prospect, Clyde thought, because it suggested a continuation of the Kennedy years, in which well-founded categories began to seem irrelevant, in which a certain fluid movement became possible, in which sex, drugs, and dirty words began to unstratify the culture.
"I think you ought to dance," Edgar said.
Clyde looked at him.
"It's a party. Why not? Find a suitable lady and spin her around the floor."
"I do believe the man is serious."
"Then come back and tell me what you talked about."
"Do I remember a single step?"
You were quite a good dancer, Junior. Go ahead, do your stuff. It's a party. On the floor, the guests were doing the twist with all the articulated pantomime of the unfrozen dead come back for a day. Soon the white band reemerged, and the music turned to foxtrots and waltzes. Clyde watched the slowly shuffling mass of careful dancers, barely touching, heedful of hairdos and jewelry and gowns and masks, and always on the alert for other fabulous people, heads turning, eyes bright in the great black-and-white gyre. "Yes, show your true colors," Edgar said with a twisted grin. So that was it. Tipsy and bitter. All right, thought Clyde. If this was to be a night in which old restrictions were eased, why not a turn around the floor? He approached a woman not only masked, but wholly medieval, it seemed. A cloth wound about the head, and a long plain cloak sashed at the waist, and a tight bodice girdled high under her breasts. She smiled at him, and Clyde said, "Shall we?" She was tall and fair, and wore no makeup, and spoke without awe of the evening and its trappings. A level-headed young lady, of the sort that Edgar might admire, and therefore Clyde as well. She wore a raven's mask. Clyde's own mask, an unadorned domino, was in his pocket by now. "Are we using names?" he said, "or shall we abide by strict rules of anonymity?"
"Are there rules in effect? I wasn't aware."
"We'll make our own," he said, surprised by the slightly sexy banter he was generating. He led her in and out of pairs of bodies, ghost-floating to the tune of an old ballad from his youth. Clyde used to have women friends, but when the boss started to court other possible protégés, strong-bodied young agents who would serve a social function more than a bureau function, Clyde knew it was time to submit to Edgar's need for a steadfast and unquestioning friend, a mate of soul and word and unvarying routine. This was a choice that answered Clyde's own deep need for protection, a place on the safe side of the fortified wall. Power made his suits fit better. He saw Edgar being photographed with a group at the far end of the ballroom. Clyde recognized most of the people and noticed how eager Edgar seemed to nestle among them. Edgar's own power had always been double-skinned. He had the power of his office, of course, and also the power that his self-repression gave him. His stern measures as director were given an odd legitimacy by his personal life, the rigor of his insistent celibacy. Clyde believed this, that Edgar had earned his monocratic power through the days and nights of his self-denial, the rejection of unacceptable impulses. The man was consistent. Every official secret in the Bureau had its blood birth in Edgar's own soul. This is what made him a great man. Conflict, the nature of his desire, and the unremitting attempts he made to expose homosexuals in the government. The secret of his desire and the refusal to yield. Great in his conviction. Great in his harsh judgment and traditional background and early American righteousness. And great in his quibbling fear and dark shame, and great and sad and miserable in his dread of physical contact, and in a thousand other torments too deep to name. Clyde would have done whatever the boss required. Knelt down, bent over, spread out, reached around. But the boss only wanted his company and his loyalty down to the last sentient instant of his dying breath. Clyde saw another man, and another in executioner's hoods, and a figure in a white winding sheet.
"And that man over there, having his picture snapped," the young woman said. "That's the person you were sitting with."
"Mr. Hoover."
"Mr. Hoover, yes."
"And with him, let me see, the wife of a famous poet? The husband of a famous actress? Two unattached composers? A billionaire with a double chin." Clyde realized he was showing off. "And a stockbroker yachtsman, let me think, called Jason Vanover." and his wife, a middling painter called whatever she's called, Sachs or Wax or something.
"And you are Mr. Tolson," said the woman.
And how clever, thought Clyde, who was rarely recognized in public, and felt a bit flattered, and somewhat unsettled as well. They were dancing cheek to cheek. He saw another woman in modified medieval dress, a bit more shrouded and hooded, and it brought to mind, no, not the 16th-century painting Edgar was so morbidly fond of, the Bruegel, with its panoramic deathscape. Edgar had postcards, magazine pages, framed reproductions, and enlarged details stored and hung in his basement rumpus room. And he'd ordered Clyde to talk to officials in Madrid about the priceless original, and how he might acquire it as a gift to the American people from a Spanish nation grateful for the protective shield of U.S. armed might. But when a B-52 and a tanker collided during routine refueling earlier this year, and four hydrogen bombs came crashing to earth on the Spanish coast, releasing radioactive materials, Clyde had to deinitiate all discussions. No, not Bruegel. The nunnish woman brought to mind, of all things and all people, the hip-sick, dopester comic Lenny Bruce. No, Lenny Bruce was not a guest at the Black and White Ball. Lenny Bruce was dead. Died several months ago, at his home in Los Angeles, of acute morphine poisoning. Naked on his toilet floor, limbs gone stiff, mucus trailing out of his nose, his glassy eyes wide open, the syringe still stuck in his arm. An 8x10 police photo of the bloated body, the picture could have been titled The Triumph of Death, was in the director's personal files. Why? The horror, the shiver, the hellish sense of religious retribution out of the Middle Ages. And only hours after the body was found, a buzz began to circulate in the usual places. Dig it, Lenny's been killed by shadowy forces in the government. Linda Bird Johnson danced past with a Secret Service agent. The rumors hadn't surprised Clyde. He could smell the decade's paranoid breath, and he wondered suddenly about the woman in his arms. Had he, in fact, approached her on the dance floor? Or had she subtly stepped into his path? A man with a skeleton mask and a woman with a monk's cowl. There, standing at the edge of the bandstand. "You know my name," Clyde said, "but I'm at a loss, I'm afraid." "Which doesn't happen very often, does it? But I thought our rules tended to favor non-disclosure." They were dancing to show tunes from the 40s. She pressed slightly closer and seemed to breathe rhythmically in his ear. "Have you ever seen so many people?" she whispered, "gathered in one place in order to be rich, powerful, and disgusting together? We can look around us," she whispered, "and see the business executives, the fashion photographers, the government officials, the industrialists, the writers, the bankers, the academics, the pig-faced aristocrats in exile. And we can know the soul of one by the bitter, wrinkled body of the other, and then know all by the soul of the one. Because they are all part of the same motherfucking thing," she whispered. "Don't you think?" Well, she just about took his breath away, whoever she was. "The same thing." "What thing?" he said. "The state, the nation, the corporation, the power structure, the system, the establishment." So young and lithe and trite. He felt the electric tension of her thighs and breasts passing through his suit. "If you kiss me," she said, "I'll stick my tongue so far down your throat." "Yes, it will pierce your heart." Then everything happened at once. Figures in raven faces and skull masks, figures in white winding sheets, monks, nuns, executioners. And he understood, of course, that the woman in his arms was one of them. They formed a death rank on the dance floor, halting the music and sending the guests to the fringes. They commanded the room, a mask of silent figures, a plague, a spray of pathogens, and Clyde looked around for Edgar. The woman slipped away. Then the figures trooped across the floor, draped, masked, sheeted, and cowled. How had they assembled so deftly?
How had they entered the ballroom in the first place? He looked for old Edgar. An executioner and a nun did a pas de deux, a round of simple circling steps, and then the others gradually joined, the skeleton men and raven women, and in the end it was a graceful pavane they did, courtly and deadly and slow, with gestures so deliberate they seemed acted as well as danced. And Clyde saw his young partner move silkenly in their midst. "I will stick my tongue so far down your throat." The guests watched in a trance. 540 men and women by actual count, and musicians and waiters and other personnel, and men assigned to guard the jewelry of the women, all part of the audience for an entertainment other than themselves, respectful, hushed, and half-stunned. "It will pierce your heart." When they were finished, the troops stood in a line and removed their headpieces and masks. Then they opened their mouths, saying nothing, and directed hollow stares at the guests. An extended moment, a long, gaping silence in the columned hall. They departed single file. A couple of minutes later, Clyde found the boss, and they went to the men's room to collect themselves.
"Enjoy your dance, Junior?"
"I think I know who they are."
"Didn't you say that last time we were in here?"
"A group little seen and less known. Campus demonstrations, mostly. No one, and this is odd."
"What?"
the boss barked. "No one in Eternal Security has come up with a name for the group. They've been known to act out protests, playing all the roles, even the police. Turn around."
"Find the links. It's all linked. The war protesters, the garbage thieves, the rock bands, the promiscuity, the drugs, the hair."
"There's some dandruff on your jacket," Clyde said. Men entered and left, carrying a single sullen murmur in and out of the tiled room. They unzipped and peed. They urinated into mounds of crushed ice garnished with lemon wedges. They unzipped and zipped. They peed, they waggled, and they zipped. Edgar stood before the mirror still masked, and the sight of him prompted Clyde to think of the secret garden behind the director's house. A sector fenced away from neighbors, and never shown to guests, where statues of nude young men rose from fountains or stood draped in fall-flaming vines. Less titillating than inspirational, Clyde believed. This was the male form as Edgar's idealized double, a role livingly filled by Clyde. At least it used to be that way in the days when Edgar would stealthily tilt a mirror so he could lie in bed and watch Junior doing push-ups in the adjoining room. That was 1939 in Miami Beach. This was 1966 in New York, and we are living in muddle and shock. He'd let that girl charm and tempt him, and he'd liked it, and he'd been disappointed when she slipped away before the kiss, and he'd been played for a fool in the oldest way, that radical and ravishing, self-possessed, heartless, come-hither bitch. Back in the ballroom, half the guests were gone. The rest measured up the time so their departure would not seem influenced by the spectacle, the protest, whatever it was, the mockery of their sleek and precious evening. The society band played some danceable numbers, but nobody wanted to dance anymore. Edgar and Clyde sat drinking with a putty-colored man in smoked glasses, and his over-masked wife, satin wings, coke feathers, and embedded diamonds. Possibly mafia, Clyde surmised. Edgar would not speak to anyone. He sat, drank, and hated. He had the sheen of last things in his eye. Clyde knew this look. It meant the director was meditating on his coffin. It gave him dark solace planning the details of his interment. A lead-lined coffin of 1,000 pounds plus, to protect his body from worms, germs, moles, voles, and vandals. They were planning to steal his garbage, so why not his corpse? Lead-lined, yes, to keep him safe from nuclear war, from the ravage and decay of radiation fallout. And when he died, whatever the circumstances, they would suddenly,
all those elements that despised his unchecked power. They would invert their distrust and begin to float rumors that the director himself was the victim of a wry homicide planned and carried out by unknown parties in the vast and layered webwork of the state. This is how the boss would finally draw some sympathy. An old man put to sleep in a complex scheme so expedient and deceitful as to be widely admired, even as it was only half believed. And Clyde himself was already prepared to half believe it. Edgar dead, pray God, not for 10, 15, 20 years yet. Maybe the '60s would be over by then. The woman in the gaudy mask said, "You think they'll be waiting outside, those creeps, to make me miserable all over again?" The husband said, "It's nearly 4 a.m. Hey, they gotta sleep sometime." At 4 a.m. they were waiting outside. Clyde and Edgar watched from the lobby. The last partygoers straggled out, and the protesters rasped and chanted, wearing children's masks again. An hour later it finally ended. Edgar and Clyde left by the main entrance and went down to the Cadillac as the spent trash of a day and a night in a great coastal city went wind-skidding through the streets. The armored limousine rolled slowly back to the Waldorf. Yes, the director would finally get some sympathy from the same people who made jokes about them both. Smutty, swishy jokes. But Edgar and Clyde were not a couple of old queens doddering on. They were men of sovereign authority. And Edgar did not intend to yield control any time on this earth. Clyde spotted the bug. He glanced at Edgar, who sat mute and brooding in his sequined mask. He'd worn the mask steadily since dinner. Hard, cold, laconic, with all the private fury of some unassuageable pain, he wore the leather mask because it eased, if only briefly, the burden of control. And when Clyde spotted the bug, the pokey little Volkswagen with its incandescent doodles and whorls, he decided to say nothing to Edgar. The car was 100 feet behind them, like a day-glow roach, slow and sleepless and clinging. He said nothing to the boss because the night had been filled with shock and distress, and he wanted to absorb this final, bodeful moment on his own. He was Junior, after all, now and always, willingly, necessarily, however tired and befooled, the life companion and loyal second man.
This ends Disc 19.